For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Fred Sale, and coming up today, award-winning author Val Wood discusses her new novel, The Lonely Wife, and her work supporting people with sight loss. Amanda Robson investigates domestic discord in her taut new psychological thriller, My Darling. We catch up with loyal listener Penny Melville Brown and find out what she's been reading. Producer Hannah has a tribute to the late Jeffrey Palmer. And we return to Val Wood to share the books of her life. That's all coming up in today's show.
Val Wood is an award-winning author of romantic historical fiction and has been called the Catherine Cookson of Hull. And the similarities don't end there. Like Cookson, she's also a keen supporter of local libraries and sight loss charities. On the eve of the publication of her 26th novel, Val Wood joined me to tell me more.
It's lovely, and it's particularly good to be speaking to someone from the RNIB. You do such fantastic work. Well, The Lonely Wife is coming out on the 12th of November, which also happens to be my birthday. I won't give you the numbers of that. It's the 26th book. I'm really excited about it. It has a lovely cover. I know a lot of your listeners won't be able to see that, but I'm really thrilled with the look of it. And I hope the story will be good too.
So can you describe the cover and the story?
Yes, I can indeed. The cover depicts the Wolds, if you know the Wolds in Yorkshire. It's a low-lying area, not hilly, but it has a beautiful undulating. And the area I have chosen is, I would say, about 15 miles from Hull, and it's near the Humber estuary, which the estuary is a particular friend of mine. I always use it in my books, and it has almost become a character. But in the picture, with the background of the low walls, I have a young woman, very young woman, with a baby in her arms. And she's looking rather as if she might cry, but she has found herself in a very difficult situation, inasmuch that she agreed to an arranged marriage. And that didn't turn out quite as she expected. She had a lot of difficulties. We're talking 19th century here, when women really didn't have a voice. And that theme has actually run through quite a lot of my books, where women were disregarded in some aspects. But the byline is that, is she strong enough to be able to keep her children? Because there is a big question mark about her husband saying that he will take the children away from her just because he can.
And poor Beatrix, your protagonist, is, as you say, very young. She's only 18. She's been sent off for this arranged marriage. And really, it is pretty much the only future for her unless she wants to become a spinster. She doesn't really have her own identity as far as society is concerned, although she's very much got her own identity as far as she personally is concerned.
Yes, that is very true. And when her father, of course, received this offer on her behalf, and he was a kindly man and really trying to do the best for his daughter, he said to her, you won't get a better offer than this. And so she wasn't exactly coerced, but she was persuaded to meet this man. And he seemed pleasant enough. And she thought really there was a slight kindred spirit in as much that she didn't think that he really wanted to be married, but she had agreed, and she knew on her honeymoon that it wasn't going to work because he didn't really want her so much, but he wanted the estate. But the promise of that estate was only if he married and bore a son. And so this was the main implication, that Beatrix had to have a son to Charles. And she did, as it happened, but at what cost?
Historical fiction offers a great opportunity to examine the mores of our own society from the perspective of another century. And I was wondering how you feel looking at the rights of women in the 1850s enlightens the position of women today?
I rather think that it does. Whether or not women of today would listen and learn from that is debatable, I would say, because they would say it's a different time. And of course, it is a different time and entirely different circumstances. But as a writer of today, much older, of course, than Beatrix, I am writing from a 21st century viewpoint. But because I love history and I have read a lot about women's rights, I can see the difficulties. And to go from being a young daughter with her whole life before her and then becoming married to a man who has complete control over her, I think actually that could happen today. We do hear of women being under the thumb of a partner or a husband or even a father, and they don't always know what to do about it. But today, of course, there are ways around that. But back then in the 19th century, a woman belonged to either her husband or her father, and she had no rights in what happened. And there was a woman called Mrs. Caroline Norton. She was married to a man who was very influential, but he was a horrible man. He used to beat her. He wouldn't let her do anything of her own. And when she had children, he said he was taking them away from her. So this is where I've taken my main details of my fictional story. This was a real story. And Mrs. Caroline Norton, she actually lost her children. Her husband took them away, said she couldn't have them. She took him to court. She was a very well-established woman and was friends with various people, important people in Parliament. She appealed to them to change the law. And it didn't work, not immediately anyway, but she kept on fighting for the rights of her children. And eventually, of course, the law was changed that children could remain with their mothers until they became of the age of, I think it was 13. This was made law in England. What her husband did, he took the children to Scotland. The law was different there. And so she never, ever saw her children again. I thought that must have been absolutely heartbreaking. And so this is what Beatrix had in mind when she thought she was going to lose her children, that she might never see them again. And, you know, it's just unimaginable, really, that that could happen. So I'd like to take some aspect of real life in the 19th century and transport it into my novels too.
Your research into the history is impeccable throughout all 26 of your novels, as is your description of the local area around Hull and the East Riding. It's very much a part of all of your novels.
Yes, it becomes a character in a way. I've lived here in the East Riding since I was a teenager, 13 I think I was when we came from West Yorkshire. And I've embraced Hull and the East Riding. They're nice people here. And there's something about the area, there's something about the estuary and the North Sea that appeals to not only writers, but to poets and musicians as well. And the whole place is awash with arts people. It really is. And for me, as I said earlier, with the estuary, that does become part of the story. It becomes a character. And with this book, I have concentrated mainly on the area. I've used the farming community in this book. And Hull hasn't got a full part in it, but it has a place always. I try to use different parts of the area because I have people saying to me, we should use our village in your books, which is really so very complimentary. But happily as well, because books do travel, particularly at the moment they travel. And I get letters and emails from people who live in Canada and New Zealand and Australia who have emigrated from East Riding. And they say it really gives them a taste and a remembrance of home, which I find is just so kind.
And you are as closely associated to the area as Catherine Cookson was to the Northeast. It's a wonderful accolade to have to be the Catherine Cookson of Hull. And of course, your first novel, The Hungry Tide, won the inaugural Catherine Cookson Award.
Yes, that's right.
Do you feel a weight of responsibility now to the local area?
This is the place where I'm comfortable. When I sit at my desk in the corner of my office, I'm back in the 19th century. I'm living in Hull or the East Riding, and I walk the streets. Now, with my first and second book, and the third as well, which were not a trilogy, but there was a connection, I used to go into Hull. I'd lived just outside Hull, in Holderness, actually, where the book eventually went to, the first book. And I used to walk and stride out how long it took me between one street and another, so that I could get the details right. I mean, this is long before I was published that I used to do that. And so I was actually putting myself in the place of my characters who were living in 19th century Hull. So I became very much at home there, and I felt as if I knew every old street that actually had gone, that had been blitzed by Hitler during the Second World War. A lot of the buildings were no longer there, but I had lots of history books I could look at on the history of Hull, and I knew what was there before. And even with my third book, with Annie, when Annie in the second book has committed a crime and runs down to the estuary, doesn't know where to go, and I pictured her standing there on the banks of the estuary, wondering what to do with her life. And I was Annie. I was there as her, because authors have to breathe life into their characters, otherwise it doesn't work.
And you've become enmeshed in the local area in many other ways. I know you're a very keen supporter of the Hull Library. You've established your own literary prize to encourage local authors, and you are the Vice President of Site Services Hull and East Riding.
That's right, I am. Well, a long connection there with Site Support Hull. Back in the 80s, about the time when I started seriously writing, I saw a piece in the local newspaper to say that the Holland District Talking Magazine were looking for volunteers. And I thought, well, I can do that. I mean, my granny was blind, so I knew what it would be like to be blind or partially sighted. And so I joined in with the Holland District Talking Magazine, TMB we used to call it there. And I was with them for nearly 30 years as a reader and as an editor and preparing all the material to be read out onto cassette tape as it was then. And I just loved that period. But because of being with them, there was also this connection with HERIB, as it was then, the Hull and East Riding Institute for the Blind, which then changed to Sight Support Hull. And so I've just been with them too for a long, long time. And I'm now vice president of the charity in Hull, which is such an honour for me. It really is such an honour.
I know you're also a passionate supporter of talking books, and that many of your books are available from the RNIB Talking Books Library, such as this copy of The Kitchen Maid, which is narrated by Sherry Baines.
Stephen had been reassuring and patient, as Jenny had cried and cursed him as he'd urged her to push. "For God's sake, I am pushing," she'd screamed at him, and then immediately apologised. "Sorry, sorry, sorry." "It's coming, it's coming," he'd urged her, then gently laid his hand on her naked belly to calm her before easing the baby from her. He held up the slippery newborn infant and gently patted its back until a mewling cry issued from tiny lungs. There was a transfixed look of wonder on his face as he gazed at the infant. Then turning to Jenny, he said, "You have a beautiful daughter, Jenny." She heard the catch in his voice and saw the glisten in his eyes as he placed the baby in her arms. "A lovely little girl." "But it should have been a boy," was Jenny's first thought. "That had been my plan, to produce a son as Christie's heir. I would have taken him to the Ingrams when he was grown up and said, 'Here he is, the rightful successor to the Ingram name.'" She looked down at the child and then gave a start as she realised that Stephen was speaking to her.
Sherry Baines narrating The Kitchen Maid, written by my guest Val Wood. So presumably, Val, the new novel, The Lonely Wife, is in production as a talking book as we speak.
It is indeed, and it is read by the wonderful Anne Dover. I ask for her all the time now for my books. She just has the right voice, she has the right accent for the area, and she's just a wonderful narrator.
Now, my guess is that you've probably already made a start on your 27th novel.
I have made a start, and I have called it Children of Fortune, and it's actually the children of Beatrix and Charles, and following on in the same family. So hence, Children of Fortune, of course, which is what they had. I won't give away the ending of The Lonely Wife because it's, well, I just won't. But I decided that I would use the children again and see what happened to them when they grew up. But it's been difficult this year. I think we've had so many anxieties, wouldn't you agree, that we're not quite sure of our future or what is going to happen. But anyway, I'm on a bit of a roll with it all now, so I'm hoping, fingers crossed, that it will come out all right.
Well, I know that thousands of people are looking forward to the publication of The Lonely Wife on the 12th of November, and I think it's a suitably wonderful birthday present from you to us.
Well, perhaps so, yes.
Val Wood, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On and for taking us into the world of The Lonely Wife.
Thank you so much, Red. It's been so very enjoyable.
A wide selection of books by Val Wood is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. And Val will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
This Christmas, see fairy tales differently with RNIB. Our new read-along storybook, Red and the Wolf, is the perfect Christmas gift for the children in your life. Challenging perceptions of disability through a beautiful retelling of a classic tale with a modern twist. Red can't see very well, but that doesn't stop her overcoming the obstacles she faces.
Shall I guide you to Granny's cottage?
No, thanks. I'm not allowed to talk to strangers, and I'm really good at finding my own way.
Aimed at children aged 3 to 7, the book comes with an audio version of the story, including sound effects and audio prompts, to tell little ones when to turn the page, so children can listen to the story and follow the text at the same time, helping them to read independently. Available for just £8.99, including UK delivery, find out more and order in time for Christmas at readalong.org.uk. 100% of the profits from sales of Red and the Wolf goes to RNIB, supporting blind and partially sighted people and helping to create a world where there are no barriers for people with sight loss.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. And now, before we hear from Penny Melville Brown...
Amanda Robson is a Sunday Times best-selling author. The titles of her novels, Obsession, Envy and Guilt, give a clue to the dark psychological themes that she likes to explore. And her latest book, My Darling, is no exception. It's a claustrophobic tale of domestic discord, as she explained when she joined me from her home in the Brecon Beacons. Amanda Robson, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
The new book has just come into the RNIB Talking Books Library, and for anybody who hasn't picked it up yet, can you just set the scene for us?
It's a psychological thriller. It's my fourth novel, and it begins when the neighbours from hell move next door to one of the main protagonists. It's a crime novel, and it's quite unusual. It's got an opposite angle to a lot of crime novels because it's, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to tell the reader that you quite quickly find out who commits the rather unpleasant murder and why. And then all the intrigue is who goes down for the murder, because it's very forensically complicated. Several of the main protagonists have forensic knowledge, and a lot of the story is everybody double-crossing everybody else forensically. So it's quite a scientific, crimey tale.
It's a dark tale of obsession and control and revenge.
Yes, it certainly is.
The four protagonists, they're pretty unpleasant, yeah. And they're setting out to destroy each other.
Yes, I'm afraid so. My characters are very dark, and it's a real psychological thriller with everybody trying to sort of destroy everybody else. It is dark, and I think in some ways people do quite enjoy reading dark things, because generally whatever problems you've got in your own life, it won't be as bad as these, and I think it just takes you away from normal life. My books are all set in a domestic situation, and then although the characters tend to do terrible things, they do them for a reason. There's a psychology behind why they do it. A lot of my novels are more why people do it rather than who's done it, although in this case it's a whodunit as well because of the forensics.
And you really enjoy conflict, and a lot of the conflict that you build comes from claustrophobic situations.
Yes, it does. That's very well observed. I'm interested in toxic relationships, and a definition of a toxic relationship is one that you can't get away from. You need it. That's why the person gets away with so much. So there's always a reason. When there's domestic abuse, and the person who's being abused will feel they can't leave the other person for some reason, whether they're financially dependent or emotionally dependent in some way, and they can't escape. Because if you could escape, then you wouldn't have the claustrophobia and you wouldn't have the reason to stay, and it wouldn't be a toxic relationship.
As you indicate, some of your protagonists have suffered psychological damage in the past, and that bubbles up and informs some of the forensic investigation that you go through. I was struck by how much of the evidence is mental as well as physical in your novels.
Yes, when I started writing, I was much more interested in the mental and the whole mind game thing. That's been my main interest. And I have found writing this last novel the most difficult one I've written, because I had to be so scientifically tight as well. And I had a senior crime scene investigator who very kindly advised me. She likes crime fiction. She's a friend of a friend of mine. She was really helpful. And I have another friend who's very senior in the World Health Authority. Well, she's just retired, but she's given me quite a lot of chemical advice. And then I've got another friend senior in the police. I think at one point I was speaking to 7 different experts to make sure I got my facts okay. I'm not saying I haven't bent them. If you look in my acknowledgements, a bit of a disclaimer, because if I have done something slightly wrong, I don't want my super experts all getting in trouble. But I have had a lot of scientific research to get this novel in place.
And I believe that one of your first jobs was actually working with poisons.
I was at the poisons unit at Guy's Hospital, and I was a co-author of a book on cyanide poisoning. But I was looking at cases just to see what information we had on cyanide poisoning. I was just writing up case reports, really. But I worked there for only a year at the poisons unit. But I've got poisons and poisoning in nearly all of my books. So I think it had a deep psychological effect on me.
And I believe that you've always had a yen to be an author, ever since you were a young girl, and that it was something that you came to after a successful career and being a stay-at-home mum.
That's absolutely right. I think when I first read Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca, I was just about 12 years old, and I was absolutely intrigued by it. And I think in my mind, I thought, oh, I wish I could write a novel one day. I wonder how on earth you do this. This is amazing. And I remember then trying to read it a second time and analyze how she'd done it, which of course I couldn't. And even now, I think she's an amazing writer. I still don't think I know how she does it. She's great. But that did seek inside my head. It did seed a dream, really, to one day write a novel. And you're quite right. It wasn't until I was much older, because I had a scientific career and I was a stay-at-home mum, and I loved my time at home. But when the boys were late teenagers and I was just driving them round to rowing practice and sort of making sure there was plenty of pasta in the house because they were always eating and washing their lycra, I suddenly felt as if I'd just become an enabler rather than doing things for myself. And their life was moving forwards. They were looking forward to going to university. My husband was still really busy with his career. And I just suddenly thought, this is my time now to do what I want to do. And I always wanted to write a novel. So the very next day, I almost had a light bulb moment. And then the next day I started writing. And I was in my late 40s then. It took me quite a long time before I got an agent and a book deal, but I got my deal about 4 years ago. So it was in my mid 50s.
You've been writing very successfully and constantly since. And I believe that you actually still write the manuscript out by hand for the first draft and then type it up.
Well, what I do still write each chapter out by hand as the ideas come to me. And then I type each chapter. My first draft is always typed up because I've typed up every chapter, but I just find it flows from the pen and then I tighten it up when I type it. Somehow when I type it, it's got to be more grown up. So it's always, when you see it in print, somehow it makes you really concentrate and tighten up the language and then edit and edit and edit. So I find even if you leave it a day, the next day you can see loads of mistakes. And I don't think a manuscript's nearly finished when every time I pick it up and open it at random, I read a page and I don't want to change something. And then when I'm starting to not want to change much, I realise I have virtually finished.
And your dialogue is very strong and very tight. I wonder, do you read it back to yourself?
Yes, I always read everything back and I check everything about 6 or 7 times. And it is odd that my writing is tight because when I'm speaking, I waffle a lot. I'm very chattery. So I find it really strange that I'm one of those writers who's always fighting to get enough words. I can tell a whole huge story. A novel needs to be like a first draft, about 70,000 words. And a lot of my friends write 80, 90. Some of them do a first draft 120,000 and have to cut stuff out. But with me, I tell the whole story sometimes in a nut. In 50,000, and my editor is more likely to say to me, can't we have a bit more about this and that, which is odd given how vociferous I am.
Each of your characters has a very strong and very individual voice, and you write from multiple points of view. Do the voices come to you fully formed, or do you have to shape them through the writing?
Well, that's interesting that you should say, because with my first novel, I remember when my editor read it, she said that the voices were too similar. So maybe I've got a little bit better with experience at trying to make sure they are different and imagine them in my head from the start. And I do put a lot of thought into it as I go. I imagine each scene as I'm writing it in my head. I used to love amateur dramatics. I sort of act it out in my head as I'm writing it. And so I think maybe the more experience I get, the more I do think to myself, this character would only listen to this type of music, or they would only eat this sort of food. And I think I have got better at immersing myself in the character. But I think to begin with, when I first started writing this type of work, it was very plot driven. I made up the plot first. Well, I still do that. I make up the plot first and then I decide about the characters. I think because yesterday I was writing a piece for my new novel and I was about to have her listening to Radio 1, and then because I would quite like to listen to Radio 2 or Radio 1, and then I thought, oh, no, this character likes classical music. Can I change it? Anyway, so it was very nice what you said, that my characters have different voices. Could you worry about that, writer? So that's a nice compliment. Thank you.
The fact that you write from multiple points of view means that all four of your novels have had more than one narrator each. And the latest, My Darling, is wonderfully read by Laura Costello and Matt Addis. Do you have anything to do with selecting the narrators yourself?
I don't get like a free run to just select whoever I want. I think my publishing house, Avon HarperCollins, they do it very well. I think they have a lady who specialises in selection, but they seem to go to a very good agency because they have super actors and actresses. And that more lately, they have let me choose from a selection of an already good group. So they've already got 6 men and 6 women who are all very good. And I did particularly like the voices of these two for the last one. And I chose the ones for the one before, and I've been thrilled with what they've done.
Dinner parties have never been my thing. Trapped around a table making small talk. But my new neighbour Jade coerced me into accepting her invitation. With a nod of the head. With the solidity of her face. So, at 8 p.m. on Friday evening, I find myself standing with you, Alistair, on Jade and Thomas's doorstep, clutching a bottle of red wine and 12 yellow roses. The door opens. Jade. A big woman, nearly 6 foot tall, short, dark hair, the makeup is a sin type. Do come in, she beams. We step inside a hallway of mirrors and lights. I hand her the roses and wine. You shouldn't have, she says, voice so hard I almost guess she means it. She leaves them on a glass dresser as we follow her along the hallway, through the dining room. The table is laid for supper. Silver mats, silver goblets, heavy silver cutlery, a centrepiece of shiny black orchids. We arrive in a large sitting room containing toffee-coloured sofas draped with cowhide, which scream against the period of the house. Why did they choose a Victorian house when they own furniture like this? Jade's husband is standing by a cocktail bar built of oak with brass-covered handles. I've only ever seen anything like this in 1970s sitcoms.
Laura Costello narrating My Darling, written by my guest, Amanda Robson. And Amanda, I believe that you've got a very personal reason for being glad that your books are recorded as audiobooks.
Oh, yes, I do, because my mum has macula. She's coped very well, actually. She's been very lucky, really, given she was diagnosed with it 20-odd years ago. But in the last couple of years, she really has stopped being able to read words. And she loves books. I mean, my passion for readings come from my grandmother and my mother. And it's great that she's getting such pleasure now out of audiobooks. And she's listening to some really intense, complicated literature. I mean, she's 87. I'm very impressed with what she's listening to. Some of it's quite heavy going, very intellectual. So she's obviously got all her marbles. But it's lovely to know that there's a world of this wonderful literature out there. And I think the actors and actresses have a real way of actually improving the sound of the writing, don't they, with their intonation. I mean, they can make quite a boring sentence sound interesting just with the variation in their voice. I don't quite know how they manage with the spacing. Well, because, you know, because I love reading out loud. I almost, when I'm writing, I think it out loud in my head. But I think it's because I did amateur dramatics, so I'm interested in the sound of words. When I'm writing, I always think about what they sound like.
And as you say, you're already working on book 5. Can you give us a sneak preview or a title?
At the moment, its working title is Daughter-in-Law, but it's really about an evil mother-in-law. And the daughter-in-law is also not very nice because she's been driven to poison her mother-in-law, which isn't great. But I'm loving writing it. I'm getting revenge. I had a difficult mother-in-law. I'm getting imaginary revenge.
And more poison.
Yes, even more poison.
Well, I hope you'll come back onto the show next year to talk about Daughter-in-Law. But in the meantime, I've got to get back to My Darling. Amanda Robson, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On and for giving us an insight into your life as a writer.
Thank you very much for inviting me. As I said, it's been a real thrill to be here.
All four of Amanda Robson's gripping psychological thrillers are available as talking books from the RNIB Library.
The current times can be especially challenging for people with sight loss.
For dedicated advice, support, or to access our free talking books and reading services, call RNIB's helpline on 0303 123 9999.
The helpline's open 8 till 8 on weekdays and Saturdays from 9 till 1.
Standing with you through every challenge. RNIB. See differently.
And now, let's join Penny Melville Brown, who's been travelling all over Europe from the comfort of her armchair.
Penny Melville Brown is a retired naval commander and the founder of Disability Dynamics and Baking Blind, both of which seek to highlight the capabilities of blind and other disabled people. She's also an avid reader with a serious audiobook habit and has kindly agreed to record a series of book reviews for the show. Welcome back to the show, Penny, and where are you taking us today?
Well, Red, I thought today we go back to Europe because I love a lot of the European detective and thriller and crime novels. So I wanted to start today with Nicholas Freeling. And you know when you suddenly pick up a book and you think, gosh, I've heard of this name but can't remember how and where. Well, this is the man who wrote the Van der Valk books. And some of your listeners may remember that that was a very popular television series, again, decades and decades ago. But this book, well, in fact, there are two. These two books are Lake Isle and What Are the Bugles Blowing For? which is a bit of a mouthful. And these are not the Van der Valk character, but this is written in the later years of his life by Nicholas Freeling. He was living in Strasbourg in France then. And he's writing with a main character called Henri Castaing, who is a member of the judicial police. And in Where the Bugles Are Blowing For, you're getting a real sense of how the French judicial system was working in those days. And then Fair Isle, which is an even nicer book, I thought, is all about how home, a house, where you live, is the very essence of one's being and one's aspirations, and is a major driving force in life. Both of them have got nice little mystery stories, nothing overcomplicated, but really good character development, I thought. And what, of course, is lovely is the sense of France you get, the sense of how people live, how they eat, where they go, and who they mix with. Quite different from our own society, but really recognisable. Loved them.
Fickle weather. It had clouded over again, making Castaing hope it wouldn't be one of those inquiries spent with permanently damp trouser legs. By the map, the village wouldn't be over 7 or 8 minutes, but it took their car double. The familiar phenomenon. Roads carrying double the weight they were designed for. These quiet suburban gardens aroar with the stream of heavy trucks. Innocuous country crossroads which had accumulated so many accidents that traffic lights had had to be put in. This wasn't country, this was suburb. Even the last bit of the side road, oldish villas masked by high walls, was unsafe. Far too many blind bends. Another argument against high stone walls, now considered as grossly antisocial.
Philip Franks narrating Lake Isle by Nicholas Freeling, which is available from the RNIB Library, as is What Are the Bugles Blowing For?
OK, and now we're going to Sicily. And this is the great Inspector Montalbano series by Andre Camilleri. Now, some of these were also featured in television series, but of course, they were speaking Sicilian, and I think there were probably subtitles, which were complete waste of time for most visually impaired people. So I do recommend the books. Inspector Montalbano is a delightful man, loves his food, lives in this idyllic house right on the beach where he can run into the sea in his underpants every morning to go for a swim, and has this amazing team of police officers who work for him, who are just like the Keystone Cops, but they too add their own sort of nuance to all the books. The Age of Doubt is all about diamond smuggling, and it's got that little bit of passion as Montalbano, who's about age 58 now, is starting to fall for a young woman and puts his other great love aside, but only for a very short time. I really love these books. It is a completely different lifestyle, and by the time you've heard how the Sicilians behave with each other, it's completely different people too. Just adorable.
His office was unusable. Water was pouring from the ceiling as if there were 10 broken pipes overhead. Since Mimi Augello wouldn't be coming in that morning, the inspector took over his deputy's room. Around 1 o'clock, as he was getting up to go out for lunch, the phone rang.
Chief, Adabi, the Arbor office on a phone, but I don't think the man's a officer, cause he says he's a lieutenant. What's his name? Damn, I forget.
Cat, a lieutenant is an officer, even though you don't have to be an officer to work at the Harbour office.
Oh, really? So what's it mean?
What's what mean? Oh, never mind. I'll explain later. Put him on.
Daniel Philpott narrating The Age of Doubt by Andrea Canaleri, which is available from the RNIB Library.
Here's my next selection, which is from Sweden. And this is from the series of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And listeners will probably know that Stieg Larsson wrote the first 3 books of this series. And then, unfortunately, he died. And it was taken over by a chap called David N. And I can never pronounce or recognise his surname. So I'm going to call him David Lagerfeld. And perhaps you can look him up on your system and pronounce it correctly. But this Girl Who Lived Twice book, again, it features Solander, Lisbeth Solander, as the girl with some degree of autism, but also super genius. And aren't all the characters geniuses in these books? And her sidekick, Mikael Blomkvist, who is the journalist. And this is a story about dastardly activities, sibling rivalry, climbing Mount Everest, a Sherpa, all sorts of fascinating stuff and really gripping. And if you love The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, this new writer, David, his two books that I've read so far of the series are just as excellent and really worth following.
The telephone buzzed. It was an unknown number, and Blomkvist ignored it. He had just left his apartment and was on his way down Hundsgatan towards Slussen and Gamlastan with no clue where he was heading. He wandered aimlessly through the lanes until at last he sat down at an open-air café and ordered a Guinness. It was 7 in the evening, but still warm. Laughter and applause could be heard coming from Schwepsholmen, and he looked up at the blue sky and felt a mild, pleasant breeze coming off the water. He tried to persuade himself that life was not, after all, so bad. But even after a beer, and then a second, he wasn't convinced. So he paid and decided to head home to do some work.
Saul Reichlin narrating The Girl Who Lived Twice by David Lagercrantz, which is also available in Braille from the RNIB Library. Well, Penny Melville Brown, thank you so much for that terrific European tour of crime fiction, and for being a guest on the show again. I look forward to you returning, and I hope you'll come back in a few weeks' time to transport us off to somewhere else.
Red, it's always such fun. And what it means is, when I'm reading and thinking about how would other people like this book. So it gives a little bit of purpose to reading as well as just my own enjoyment.
Well, thanks again, Penny. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. And if you'd like to share the books that you've been enjoying with the listeners, why not drop us a line? The email address is radio@rnib.org.uk. And if you're a book lover, don't forget to tune in to Read On every Friday at 1 p.m. and always available as a podcast from your favourite provider. Just search for Read On, the audiobook show.
Now, before we return to hear the books of Val Wood's life, here's producer Hannah with her tribute to the late Geoffrey Palmer.
Sadly, last month, veteran actor Geoffrey Palmer passed away at the age of 93. Born and brought up in London, he showed no early signs of an interest in the life of a thespian until a girlfriend encouraged him to join the local Amdram group. This launched a career that would span 6 decades. Palmer's hangdog face is probably best known for his appearance in 3 incredibly popular sitcoms. In The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin, he played Leonard Ruster's right-wing brother-in-law, constantly scrounging meals. In Carla Lane's Butterflies, he was a gloomy, bad-tempered dentist married to Wendy Craig, his dissatisfied wife. And in As Time Goes By, he played opposite Judy Dench as an ex-army officer who rediscovers love later in life with a woman he met during the war.
Good morning, sir. Welcome to the Shangri-La Lounge.
The what lounge?
Shangri-La, sir.
I assume no one ever ages in here.
Pardon?
Never mind.
Is it a table for one, sir?
Well, as there's only one of me, that seems a reasonable assumption.
This way, sir. Sir?
I'll take this one.
That's a table for 6, sir.
Who knows? I may be joined by 5 people. If I'm suddenly joined by 11 people, I may need to move to a table for 12.
Very well, sir. How will you be paying? Cash or charge to the room?
I haven't ordered anything yet.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. What would you like? We are serving brunch.
Are you? I assume between lunch and dinner you serve linner.
No, sir. Tea.
Just bring me a pot of coffee, would you?
Yes, sir. And how will you be paying? Is it cash or charge to the room?
The room 405.
Right. If you'd like to put your name in capitals there, sir, and your signature there.
Would you like to see my birth certificate as well?
I'll get you coffee, sir. Oh, and there's a gentleman waving at you.
That's all I need.
Lionel High, my favourite writer.
Hello, Alistair.
Listen, I need to talk to you ASAP.
All right. Would you like a COC?
Sorry?
A cup of coffee?
Nice one. Good idea.
Miss?
You're just brewing, sir.
Am I really?
Geoffrey Palmer in the BBC radio broadcast of As Time Goes By. Apart from their 13 years together in comedy, Judi Dench and Geoffrey Palmer crossed paths twice on the big screen, appearing together in the James Bond film Tomorrow Never Dies, and again in costume drama Mrs. Brown. Dench commented that his true personality was nothing like the curmudgeonly characters he would often play. You would never think he would misbehave, Dame Judi said. There were a lot of outtakes. He got me into endless trouble. They were often corpsing on set, and on one occasion, when Dench had a fit of the giggles, Palmer, feigning impatience, asked, "Is Eileen Atkins free? Maggie Smith, perhaps?" Although he did appear on stage, he much preferred the medium of television and film. He is the only actor to appear in three of the British Film Institute's 100 Greatest British Television Programmes, with Fawlty Towers, Kathy Come Home and Doctor Who. In fact, he appeared in three separate Doctor Who episodes, unfortunately dying each time. Others know him by his voice. He uttered the three infamous words for Audi in the 1980s, Vorsprung durch Technik. And as one of the narrators of Grumpy Old Men, he was quoted as saying, "I am not grumpy, I just look this way." He was also frequently heard on radio, in both comedy series such as the Maltby Collection, or dramatisations like Les Miserables. His versatility was impressive. Many will remember him in the first Paddington movie, The Madness of King George, or A Fish Called Wanda, but my favourite would have to be the marvellous Just So stories by Rudyard Kipling on audio. He brought a unique wisdom to these classic tales and convinced you to suspend your disbelief for a little while.
The whale swam and swam and swam, with both flippers and his tail as hard as he could for the hiccoughs, and at last he saw the mariner's natal shore and the white cliffs of Albion. And he rushed halfway up the beach and opened his mouth wide and wide and wide and said, "Change here for Winchester, Ashualot, Nashua, Keene, and stations on the Fitchburg Road." And just as he said Fitch, the mariner walked out of his mouth. But while the whale had been swimming, the mariner, who was indeed a person of infinite resource and sagacity, had taken his jackknife and cut up the raft into a little square grating, all running crisscross, and had tied it firm with his suspenders.
Geoffrey Palmer, narrating How the Whale Got His Throat, from Rudyard Kipling's Just So Stories.
Are you filming, Mum?
Yeah.
Hello, UK. My name is Kira, and I need your help with something. I love Christmas, but sometimes I'd feel left out of some of the magic. Blind kids like me will write to Santa, but Santa needs help writing back to us.
Because Santa can't write Braille.
But here's how you can help. If you text letter to 70597 to give £5 today, you could help R&IB and Santa send an accessible letter to a child this Christmas. Last year, Santa sent me a letter in Braille. He even told me I was on the nice list. Knew it! Thanks to R&IB and Santa, I felt included in the magic of Christmas too. Now, I want more of the 14,500 blind and partially sighted kids in the UK to feel the same. Please text today or search R&IB Christmas. R&IB. See Christmas differently.
Now it's back to Val Wood for the books of her life. Val, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, absolutely there was. And that book, which it will resonate with a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, was Little Women, Louisa M. Alcott. I was only young when I first read that, and I didn't realise that it was literature. And nor did I realise that many years on, it would inspire me to become an author. And last year, of course, I wrote Four Sisters. Now, this wasn't at all a copy of Little Women, because no one could possibly do that. But it did inspire me to write about a family of four sisters. and I absolutely loved it. It took me back to the time when I used to read such a lot.
Joe? Joe, where are you? Cried Meg at the foot of the garret stairs. Here, answered a husky voice from above. And running up, Meg found her sister eating apples and crying over the Heir of Redcliffe, wrapped up in a comforter on an old three-legged sofa by the sunny window. This was Joe's favorite refuge, and here she loved to retire with half a dozen russets and a nice book to enjoy the quiet and the society of a pet rat who lived nearby and didn't mind her a particle. As Meg appeared, Scrabble whisked into his hole. Joe shook the tears off her cheeks and waited to hear the news. Such fun! Only see! A regular note of invitation from Mrs. Gardner for tomorrow night, cried Meg, waving the precious paper and then proceeding to read it with girlish delight. Mrs. Gardner would be happy to see Miss March and Miss Josephine at a little dance on New Year's Eve. Marmy is willing we should go. Now, what shall we wear?
What's the use of asking that, when you know we shall wear our poplins because we haven't got anything else? Answered Jo, with her mouth full.
If I only had a silk, sighed Meg. Mother says I may when I'm 18, perhaps, but 2 years is an everlasting time to wait.
I'm sure our pops look like silk, and they are nice enough for us. Yours is as good as new, but I forgot the burn and the tear in mine. Whatever shall I do? The burn shows badly, and I can't take any out.
You must sit still all you can and keep your back out of sight. The front is all right. I shall have a new ribbon for my hair, and Marmy will lend me her little pearl pin, and my new slippers are lovely, and my gloves will do, though they aren't as nice as I'd like.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes. Oh, well, so many books, but with this one, this particular book, in actual fact, I'm cheating here, it is a series of books. Tales of the Utori by Leanne Hearn. Wonderful, wonderful, magical book. It could have been set in medieval Japan, and there are thrilling stories of magic, of battles, of bravery and love. And the first one is called Across the Nightingale Floor. And I can't stress enough, I can guarantee, however, that when you've read this first one, then you'll be sure to read the other two. Wonderful, wonderful stories.
The cicadas shrilled as loudly as ever. Frogs were calling from the paddies. In the distance, thunder echoed round the mountains. The air was heavy and humid. I was sweating, but the sweat was turning cold on my forehead. I jumped across the ditch of the last terraced field and looked down to where my home had always been. The house was gone. I went closer. Flames still crept and licked at the blackened beams. There was no sign of my mother or my sisters. I tried to call out, but my tongue had suddenly become too big for my mouth, and the smoke was choking me and making my eyes stream. The whole village was on fire, but where was everyone? Then the screaming began. It came from the direction of the shrine, around which most of the houses clustered. It was like the sound of a dog howling in pain, except the dog could speak human words, scream them in agony. I thought I recognized the prayers of the hidden, and all the hair stood up on my neck and arms. Slipping like a ghost between the burning houses, I went towards the sound. The village was deserted. I could not imagine where everyone had gone. I told myself they had run away. My mother had taken my sisters to the safety of the forest. I would go and find them just as soon as I had found out who was screaming. But as I stepped out of the alley into the main street, I saw two men lying on the ground. A soft evening rain was beginning to fall, and they looked surprised, as though they had no idea why they were lying there in the rain. They would never get up again, and it did not matter that their clothes were getting wet. One of them was my stepfather. At that moment, the world changed for me. A kind of fog rose before my eyes, and when it cleared, nothing seemed real. I felt I had crossed over to the other world, the one that lies alongside our own, that we visit in dreams. My stepfather was wearing his best clothes. The indigo cloth was dark with rain and blood. I was sorry they were spoiled. He had been so proud of them.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Well, I can always go back to Pride and Prejudice. Perfect dialogue. Sharp and humorous, and of its time. Seen the film, the book is better, as it always is. Jane Austen, of course. That's another one of my favourites.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. However little known the feelings or views of such a man may be on his first entering a neighbourhood, this truth is so well fixed in the minds of the surrounding families that he is considered as the rightful property of some one or other of their daughters. "My dear Mr. Bennet," said his lady to him one day, "have you heard that Netherfield Park is let at last?" Mr. Bennet replied that he had not. "But it is," returned she, "for Mrs. Long has just been here, and she told me all about it." Mr. Bennet made no answer. "Do not you want to know who has taken it?" cried his wife impatiently. "You want to tell me, and I have no objection to hearing it." This was invitation enough. "Why, my dear, you must know, Mrs. Long says that Netherfield is taken by a young man of large fortune from the north of England, that he came down on Monday in a chaise and four to see the place, and was so much delighted with it that he agreed with Mr. Morris immediately, that he is to take possession before Michaelmas, and some of his servants are to be in the house by the end of next week." "What is his name?" "Bingley." "Is he married or single?" "Oh, single, my dear, to be sure. A single man of large fortune, 4,000 or 5,000 a year. What a fine thing for our girls." "How so? How can it affect them?" "My dear Mr. Bennet," replied his wife, "how can you be so tiresome? You must know that I am thinking of his marrying one of them." "Is that his design in settling here?"
Emilia Fox narrating Pride and Prejudice, written by Jane Austen, which is also available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library. Well, Valwood, thank you so much for sharing your joy of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so very much. Thank you again for inviting me. I've had a lovely morning.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On is always available to download as a podcast. Just search your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. Thanks again to all my guests, and of course, to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.